Look at these numbers. After dealing with the Great Recession in his first term, the deficit under Obama dropped by an average of 11% a year in his second term. The deficit has increased by 15% a year in President Trump's first 2 years. Under President Trump, our national debt has increased by more than $2 trillion. And if this bill goes through, estimates are the Trump debt will top $4 trillion. How can Mick Mulvaney, budget hawk, support this?
Take our budget. Adopt our budget. The media and the press and the
and Congress said on arrival.
Debt on arrival is the word that everybody always uses. But if you actually went to look at it and saw what Donald Trump would do if he could pass spending bills, which he can't, you would be on your path to balance and the deficit would be down. Congress spends money.
You had Republican control of Congress for the first 2 years.
Yes, who also threw our budgets in the trash as well as debt on arrival.
That was White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney in the part of his Fox News Sunday confrontation with Chris Wallace that isn't making headlines, in which he was trying to justify his neck-snapping about-face on budget and deficit issues now that he's representing the Trump administration instead of resisting the Obama administration. Hello, America. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Welcome me back, compadres. Hey, thank you. So the clip we just played came at the very tail end of an interview that was dominated by testy exchanges over the president's war of words with Congressman Elijah Cummings and the city of Baltimore, at least the western half of it, I guess, which we will get to in a bit. But first, one of the virtues and or curses of being not just a libertarian, but a journalist who covers politics is that we have a opportunity slash responsibility to talk about actual laws that get passed. And last week, the House of Representatives, including Elijah Cummings, passed a doozy of a law with the blessing of President Trump, the aptly named Bipartisan Budget Act, which now sits at the Senate, jacks up federal spending by $320 billion per year. It blows up what remained of the budget caps imposed back in 2011. It's projected to add $1.7 trillion to a national debt that has already gone from $19 trillion to $22 trillion on President Trump's watch. And in fact, hikes spending above the already expansionary trend line that was in place before the great Tea Party hiccup of 2011 to 2014. So, Suderman, since you lull yourself to sleep by cooing budget death porn stats from the Congressional Yikes. Budget Office, why is this deal even worse than what I just laid out?
It's worse than what you laid out in part because it's the second such deal in less than a year and a half. This is basically the deal that McConnell did last year, Redux. It's the same thing again, except worse. And so what has happened under Trump is that Trump ran on, you know, oh, I'm going to cut the budget deficit and the debt's too high and we're going to fix all of that. We're going to fix it in 8 or 10 years. And instead what's happened is he's run up the deficit even in boom times. There's no economic argument for doing this. And in doing so, you mentioned this, but it's just worth reiterating. This gets rid of, completely eliminates, the signature, sole, arguably, accomplishment of the Tea Party, which was to put together a deal, the sequestration deal, that said that if Congress doesn't come together to do a budget in the normal way, follow the appropriations process every year, then what happens is there's a slow rolling series of small cuts to everything in the discretionary budget. And what this does is it stops those cuts, which would have gone into effect in January, it stops them from going into effect. So not only does this raise spending by an awful lot, not only does this raise the deficit and the debt by an awful lot, it also undoes an automatic spending cut that would have gone into effect. And then I think it's also just worth noting, since we heard the lovely Mick Mulvaney kind of refusing to defend this deal, which is a little bit interesting. He's like, well, look at the president's budget. The president's budget is a different thing, and it has all these cuts in it, right? And
He's outright lying about that.
I just want to note that the president sent Steve Mnuchin to negotiate this deal with Nancy Pelosi. This is a deal that is directly negotiated by the administration with House Democrats. So you can think of this as the Trump-Pelosi deal. That is the correct way to think about it. And here is a tweet from Donald Trump just a couple of days ago that is worth reading. Budget deal, capitalized. Gives great victories to our military and vets, also capitalized. Keeps out Democrat poison pill riders. Republicans and Democrats in Congress need to act ASAP and support this deal. This is Trump's budget. This is the budget deal that Trump wanted for his own political purposes. And if Mulvaney says that's not true, he's lying.
Yeah, and if I just want to point out, I'm looking at the budget that Mick Mulvaney and the Trump administration sent to Congress for fiscal year 2020. It proposes spending $4.7 trillion and estimates a $1.1 trillion deficit. And in the first four years of the Trump administration, again, their own numbers, they would add $4.8 trillion in debt. If we care about fiscal restraint, and we should for a number of reasons, because it's the best proxy, spending is the best proxy for the size and scope of government in everyday life. And it continues to just metastasize. But it also, deficit spending in particular, has two pernicious effects. It gives people something for free, or they think it's for free, and it slows down long-term economic growth. It is absolutely shameful to me that the Republican Party and somebody like Mick Mulvaney, who supposedly made his bones as a budget hawk is just a lying sack of shit when it comes to this kind of stuff. As bad as it was when he was defending the president's racist tweets and things like that, at least you can kind of argue, oh, you know, it's the scrum of politics or something. He's just a bald face. And as became clear in that Fox News clip that showed old clips of him, just a balding liar about everything. He is worthless. As a spokesman, he's as big a liar as Sarah Huckabee Sanders ever was.
Holy cow. Nick Gillespie, hair-shaming Mick Mulvaney. I mean, you're dealing from a position of strength there, Nick.
It's my one redoubt. Yeah, so.
Catherine, what should be, will be the title of Mick Mulvaney's White House memoir?
Taking the Poison Pill.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm here for you. No, this is like a tidbit.
You should be an editor of things that people
write. Headlines on things. Yeah, so like this is something that I think has been overshadowed both by the racism fight and also by the, oh my God, this budget is enormous fight, which, you know, both of those do take precedence. But this weird claim that somehow the real genius of this deal is that they've staved off Democratic poison pills. They agreed that no one was going to do that anymore. And I don't see any reason to believe that whatever they negotiated will be any different than how the process would have been regardless, right? So what they say is there will be no bill that includes policy provisions unless agreed to on a bipartisan basis by the four leaders with the approval of the president. But that's just the legislative process. Like, that's how this works. That's how we do appropriations bills. That's how we do budget bills. So I'm not exactly sure what the concession is that they think they got. And
it's that they get more defense spending.
Right. Well, of course, in fact, what happened is everybody spent more money because nobody cares about not spending all the money. But I guess I'm just interested in, like, why are they doing this little rhetorical jujitsu? Because, of course, one party's poison pill is another party's legitimate line item or legitimate, you know, policy preference. And so we've just made the fight one layer more meta. It will just be a meta fight about whether the fight is because the other side inserted a poison pill or not. But it moves us even farther from actually talking about whether we should spend all that money and on what.
I mean, another way of thinking about the poison pills part of this is that they're not, I mean, in some sense, they are removing poison pills. What they're agreeing to do is they're agreeing not to try to politically sabotage each other with budget provisions.
But they're not
going to. And the way they will do that is by each side essentially preemptively agreeing to spend whatever money the other side wants to on everything.
But
it is the way you get to know poison pills here is by everybody saying, no, you won't make me take a vote that will hurt with my people, and I'll agree to vote for whatever you want to spend your money on. And so the no poison pills thing isn't, I mean, you can sort of defend this as, oh, isn't it great that our political leaders are working together? But they're working together to produce policy that is objectively worse.
But I guess what I'm saying is, I agree that that is the theoretical mechanism, but in fact, this will immediately collapse back in on itself as one side, refuses to actually spend infinity money.
The other thing, the other part about this, though, is that it includes a lifting of the suspension of the debt limit for 2 years. And Trump saw that in particular as the main thing that he wanted to get out of this deal. He might have been willing to do a government shutdown, but he really didn't want to have a government shutdown and
forced
a debt limit fight
this
year, right before the election. And so what this does is it pushes the debt limit off until after the election. And, you know, the reports that I've read about how this was negotiated was he sent Mnuchin into Nancy Pelosi's office, and Mnuchin said, well, we want the debt limit suspended until after the election. How much is that going to cost us? And Pelosi said, here's how much. And they said, okay.
I also think this totally reinforces my view that anything with the word bipartisan on it is evil to the nth degree.
Wait, what about the criminal justice reform?
That was transpartisan. And I will I actually really think there's an important distinction, and I will fight you on it, but maybe not right
bad,
now.
I don't know. Trans is good when it comes to politics.
That's really
the point. Is that the position? Trying to understand your
position.
Please
do not quote me on that. I do not want angry bisexuals knocking on my Twitter door.
The point of going meta is that it allows, you know, it obfuscates any meaningful conversation. And this way, the Republicans, and you saw this with Mick Mulvaney, and all of the Republicans will still pretend to be the party of small government, and Democrats are liberal free spenders. And everybody gets to persist in this myth, which is just absolutely wrong. And I think it's, you know, this budget deal actually should force people. One of the best arguments, I think, for Donald Trump is he's better than Hillary would have been. And I actually think when you look at the budgets that he's proposed and the budget deal that he just cut, there's a serious question there, because Hillary Clinton in many ways was terrible, but she did have at least, and I hesitate to use DNA in connection with anything related to the Clinton family, but she did have some of the DNA of an actual responsible spend, you know, pay for what you spend kind of Democrat coming out of Bill Clinton's administration and whatnot. I think it's legitimate to say she would have probably
been spending less and
having less deficits.
I don't know if I completely agree with that, but Republican pressure on a Democratic administration, if you imagine that everything else had gone exactly
the same,
Republicans in Congress would have totally cynically and for political reasons, but the Republicans in Congress would have said, wait, we're not going to give you all of the stuff that you want. We are going to send you a budget that spends more on the military, but a lot less on everything else. And again, I've blamed Nancy Pelosi, Donald Trump, Steve Mnuchin, and Mick Mulvaney so far, but I also... We need to blame McConnell here for a little bit. It's really important.
Don't blame McConnell.
That's it. When it comes to bad budgeting, that is a very good rule. Never don't blame Mitch McConnell. And in particular, in this case, the Washington Post reported last week or the week before that as this deal was being put together, Mitch McConnell called Donald Trump and said, no politician has ever lost an election by spending more. And that was the advice he gave him. And you can look at the deals that McConnell has presided over and the one he is likely to sign and send to the president's desk here or put together a vote on and send to the president's desk. The deals reflect that as a guiding belief about how politics works. And to bring it back to a point that I make frequently here, what is this all about? This is about short-term electoral victory. Mm-hmm. For both parties in this case, this isn't about any kind of policy wins. At all. This is entirely about gaining and holding seats in Congress and the presidency.
Catherine,
Mitch McConnell told the New York Times, he said, this is a good deal, and it's a good deal because it achieves the number one goal on the Republican side of the aisle, providing for the common defense. And so we can spend even more money on the military that is exhausted, you know, and just more baubles. And as long as the Republicans can say, you know, it's, you know, we couldn't do any better because the Democrats run the House, but we spent more on defense, they'll fucking spend more and more until the cows come home, which will happen before the troops come home, sadly.
Catherine, the right of center universe is spending this long run up to election 2020 talking about itself as, and this very much the pro-Trump universe as well, talking about what Republicans are doing now as a bulwark against socialism. We saw that just last week when we went to Freedom Fest. And in fact, you and I and Nick, and I'm sure I used the I wrong there, and I don't care, you Nazis, gave a talk about the against the socialism of both parties. As the editor-in-chief of the Reason universe, what is, and also the proud daughter of the country of Romania.
This has been quite a journey.
What
Matt.
Does it do to your blood to hear all this? I don't know. Let me finish. Try. I'm going to get there. To hear everybody talk about like they're fighting against socialism when they're not. Damn it.
They're not. Damn it. That's true. You know. My Romanian blood doesn't have any thoughts about this one way or the other, but my libertarian blood does to just continue to utterly destroy the metaphor. And it's this, right? It's nobody's actually really being a socialist with the exception of like maybe Bernie Sanders and AOC, maybe. And instead what they're being largely speaking, largely is, redistributionists, and there has been a new kind of blatantness on the part of the left. Like when you ask Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, how are you going to pay for that? She says, you just pay for it. When you say to Elizabeth Warren, it looks like your proposed tax increase only covers one of your 47 plans.
It covers like
1.9 of your 47 plans. She says, basically, well, we'll worry about that later. You know, this sort of explicit, we are no longer worrying about paying things because it is so urgent that we make a big pile of money and then redistribute it to other people, is the kind of guiding light of the Democratic Party. But as we've just been talking about, Republicans are now doing exactly that same thing. They just want to give the pile of money to different people. And I think, you know, that's reflected in that tweet. Like we've given money to the military, and that's all that matters is cover for, you know, we've abandoned our principles of fiscal discipline to the extent that we ever had them, which wasn't very much. You know, the other piece of this, I think, is right now, and you know, I think Nick has used this metaphor, like we're just Wile E. Coyote, right? Like we're just like, we're running, we're out over the empty space. If we don't look down, maybe everything will be fine, seems to be the official position of both parties. You know, we've done okay so far. The economy hasn't completely collapsed based on this irresponsible behavior. So let's keep being irresponsible. Like, I haven't crashed my car yet, even though I've been driving drunk. So I'll keep driving drunk. Like, that's what we're doing right now. And
my four-year-old does that constantly. Like, she'll like slide down the stairs or do something willfully stupid and dangerous, and she will say, but I didn't
right.
hurt myself.
And this is so. A childish and simplistic way of looking at the world. It is dangerous. And, you know, I think the word socialism in some ways is neither here nor there, but the worst part of socialism is the part where you don't pay attention to price signals and the part where you use a central authority to redistribute money. And both of those things are being practiced equally by both parties.
Suderman, building on that point, President Trump on Monday, which is today, for those of you listening at home, was busy browbeating the Federal Reserve, saying that we really need to, that they made a disastrous decision to hike rates previously during his term, and they're widely expected to do a rate cut. There's the a sense that you could just sort of monetize debt away forever and ever. Maybe, and the argument from the left, from the Paul Krugmans of the world, has been something like that. Like, hey, debt really doesn't matter anymore because we can just, you know, we're a reserve currency. Let's just get rates down to zero and we can kind of borrow forever. What's the problem with that? Is there any reason for libertarians who've been nattering on and on about debt and deficits and possible rate increases in inflation in the future? Did we get something wrong? Is this uniquely dangerous? What is your take on the Federal Reserve politics of this week?
My take on the Federal Reserve politics of this week is actually to go back several years to an old issue of Reason magazine and a roundtable that I believe you, Matt Welch, edited and commissioned.
Blame it on me.
No, I'm not going to blame it on you. I'm going to credit you. Because if you go back and look, there was a piece, I believe that the title of the package was It Can Happen Here. And it was about how various Western countries with high debt and deficits have brought down their deficits. And it turns out that they've always done three things. When you look at Canada, when you look at the United States, when you look at other countries that have brought down their deficits significantly, what they've done are very large spending cuts, small tax hikes, and a little bit of sugar from the Federal Reserve. And that seems to be the winning formula for making budgeting work functionally, for having reasonably a good and effective budgets. And there's always been a little bit of Federal Reserve action to make those spending cuts not have the kind of immediate impact on the economy that they might otherwise have. Because it is true that if you just yank a whole bunch of government money out of the economy overnight, that's contractionary. And there's some stuff that will happen in the short term that is unpleasant. And so the Federal Reserve is there to ease that into place. And so libertarians shouldn't be like, well, the Federal Reserve shouldn't be doing anything. I think it's actually sort of a mistake to think that the Fed.
But the Federal Reserve is already rates are at zero. I mean, they're less than zero.
And you actually have central bankers in other countries where it's at less than zero. However, in this particular instance, what is going on is that the Trump administration believes that their best argument, and I think this isn't even wrong, their best argument going into 2020 is that the economy is humming. And they want to make the 2020 election entirely about the economy because traditionally that's the best indicator of whether a first-term president gets a second term. In particular, how the economy is going, I think it's about 6 or 8 months before the election. So they want next spring and early next summer. They want the economy to continue to be going strong and not in a recession until then. And they view the Fed, they view the tax package, they view putting off they view suspending the debt limit. They view all of this as a tool to keep the economy going at least long enough to get a Trump second term, which is all they really care about.
You know, it's interesting. I agree with you that that's the motivation. And also, you know, Trump obviously doesn't observe the niceties of the idea that the Fed is supposed to be independent. Presidents have always worked with the Fed or worked the Fed like you work a ref or something like that, you know, either for good or bad purposes. But he's clarifying a lot of stuff. I mean, and again, this is like what he's revealing is pretty creepy, but we should pay heed to it, that this is how it always works. One of the things that I think is interesting is that, you know, both Obama and George W. Bush, they won re-election despite they shouldn't have, but based on most of the typical indicators. And, you know, Bush turned 2004 into a national security referendum, and that's how he won. And then Obama, he should have lost. And it was just that the Republicans ran a really shitty candidate whose signature policy, you know, achievement was creating a form of Obamacare. So it'll be interesting to see if the Democrats move away from the economy as the main talking point. And in the early kind of discussions of socialism, I think they're actually moving to a place, Trump will be able to counter this, but it's kind of interesting where they're saying they're not denying that there's economic growth, but that it is, you know, fundamentally unfair and is not being shared in by more and more people. And that's kind of a good argument just from a strategy point of view.
Let's shift to the topic that everyone else is talking about, which is, as we teased at the top, Trump's ongoing, including this morning's kind of rhetorical spat with Elijah Cummings, congressman, longtime congressman of from Maryland to the Baltimore era. Just a tweet this morning from the president. Baltimore, under the leadership of Elijah Cummings, has the worst crime statistics in the nation. 25 years of all talk, no action. So tired of listening to the same old bull. Next, Reverend Al will show up to complain and protest. Nothing will get done for the people in need. Sad. He's also called Elijah Cummings racist, which is an interesting twist on things. And there are, depending on who you're listening to, kind of referendums on how Baltimore is doing as a city. Catherine, what's your kind of floating above it meta take on this discussion and also at how it's swallowing up oxygen out there?
I am perfectly positioned to do a floating above it meditate since I was on vacation last week and therefore was just kind of dimly aware that everyone was racist, I guess.
Were you in a body of water where you were literally floating?
I was floating. I don't know what I was floating above. Hopefully something less disgusting than our politics. But I did some catching up this morning and somewhat surprisingly, maybe kind of liked the take of Julian Castro, the Obama housing secretary, who, when asked about this whole kerfuffle, said, like a lot of Americans, I'm not somebody that likes to use the term or that is quick to call somebody racist. But there is a pattern there. This guy is the biggest identity politician we have seen in the last 50 years. And I think that actually sums up a lot of this. It's identity politics and the fact that it's the exact same rhetoric from Trump about both Somalia and Baltimore. Like, it's a gross place. Go back and fix it before you talk about what you want to do to the real America is telling. It's just classic othering. It's classic in-group, out-group. It's an effective political strategy, which is also bad for the country in which that strategy is practiced. And I wish this wasn't the conversation we were having. I kind of like Baltimore, but I also think we are, and maybe this is some Suderman or Gillespie bait. I think we are like in some ways reaping what we have sown, what David Simon has sown with The Wire.
Oh, dear God.
Is this actually all David Simon's fault? Is my question to y'all.
When Nick Gillespie is passing up an opportunity to talk about David Simon for 15 minutes, you know we've gone to a dark place. Nick, I would put it this way: there could be a terrific demonstration project, could there not, of kind of conservative policy making argument, which is that Democratic run cities, Democratic run states are kind of uniquely misgoverned. But that isn't this. I mean, this fight isn't really about that. Or let's say that you're not getting there with that discussion in the same way that you would have gotten there with the way, the Manhattan Institute was talking about economic policies back in the 1980s or something.
There was a moment when, I guess, when Trump first came into office and when, he and Kanye West were playing footsie, and I'm thinking in particular of Chance the Rapper, who's from Chicago, talked about Chicago as a place that was uniquely poorly governed, particularly from a black perspective, like a lower class black perspective. And he talked about how shitty the schools were and how bad the police were to, residents of low income black and ethnic neighborhoods. That is a conversation that we should be having. And Trump is not interested in that conversation, obviously. And it is, it's not a small thing to like have to admit that the president is fundamentally racist. When he sees people out there, he sees them in kind of racial blocks, his immediate gesture. And part of this is blunted by coming from New York, where I think people are more frank about a lot of conversations and things like that. And, they're just on all sides. People are nastier than they are in kind of national politics. But it's fucked up. And it doesn't mean that some of his policies are not going to be good. We brought up criminal justice reform. That's a good law. It's a good start on something, and it's going to help blacks in America. His school choice stuff helps blacks in America. Some of his economic plans help blacks in America, but it's really kind of disturbing. The biggest problem with it, in many ways, I think, is that it takes us out of that conversation, Matt. And I don't think it's uniquely Democratic either, because you can look at, there are cities in California that are run by Republicans or centrists or whatever that are screwed up, both in a financial way and in other ways. So, we have a problem with urban government in America, and I think it's bigger than either party, and it's something that should be addressed. And this will make sure that we instead are talking about whether or not Trump is a racist, how bad is he a racist. And then you have, what we saw on Fox News on Sunday, where it's Mick Mulvaney's on for 10 minutes, eight of it is going back and forth over whether the president's racist, and then two is about the bullshit in his budget.
Peter,
I just need to add in very quickly that Chance the Rapper has a new album out this weekend, and it's so good. It's called The Big Day. It's on all the music services. You should listen to it. if you like that sort of thing, you'll really like this sort of thing.
You've just preempted your what are you consuming? You now don't you don't
I
get
think
one.
He,
no.
I'm taking that as a bonus. That's like when it's like in the debates when you mention another candidate, you get 30 seconds
that's
to respond.
True.
When Nick mentions Chance the Rapper, I get 30 seconds to talk about his new album.
That's all
right.
But when I mentioned David Simon, Nick should have had 30 seconds to respond, and
I would point people to the
adreason.com, Google David Simon, Nick Gillespie, and Treme.
I was
the only person who even wanted to talk to him about that abortive New Orleans-based series that nobody liked.
He was kind of
pissy.
Yeah.
You know?
I would actually to respond to your theory, Catherine, that this is all David Simon's fault, I would actually say, I would go back a little further. This is all HBO's fault. And even more than that, this is all peak television's fault.
Because
Donald Trump comes out of the other side of peak television that we forget about, which is the reality TV boom.
Yeah.
And so you have a reality TV star taking a fictionalized view of Baltimore that was only possible because the creative guy, the head creative at the New York Times in the 1990s said, forget critics. I don't want to appeal to television critics. What I want is to produce shows that will be talked about on the New York Times op-ed page. And so he made upper middle brow, sophisticated literate shows that changed television forever. That's The Sopranos and Deadwood and The Wire and that whole sort of that trio.
First among them was Baltimore Poverty Porn.
And The Wire was a great show. It was a show made by a kind of a socialist. It's a kind of libertarian show, or at least a show that that works from a lot of libertarian.
This
insights.
Is why David Simon and, is so angry.
Yeah, yeah, he's angry that
it's like the only people who watched the show were TV critics and libertarians.
That's true.
Yeah.
And in any case, so I want to blame peak television for Donald Trump.
You know, Peter, the way you put it that way, it's we're living through a kind of like gum, melted gum version of the Reagan years. Because instead of like a Hollywood leading man and a TV presenter who at one point, Ronald Reagan, right as World War II was starting, was the second highest paid actor in Hollywood briefly. He was successful. But then by all accounts, like at various points was kind of broadcasting in his mind. He was kind of like both in and out of his movie roles or the movies and reality. But now we have Donald Trump, who is, a reality TV star and is kind of looking at the world through, his TV snippets with blood sugar spikes courtesy of McDonald's.
Who spends most of his time, as far as we can tell, just watching himself and his aides on television, or at least a huge amount of his presidential time.
So I think the other piece of this that I'm interested in, again, from my like slight vacation remove, which maybe I'm calling this wrong and y'all should feel free to just tell me to shut up and go back to the beach, which I would happily do. But it also feels like this is just the natural consequence of like being called a racist is the worst thing right now. Like I'm rounding up or down or something, but like to call someone a racist credibly and repeatedly is the worst allegation that you can lob at someone in 2019 in many ways. And so, like, were we always going to end up here? I mean, I do think that these things that Trump has said recently have really, like,
they
further
are objectively racist.
Revealed what I believe is an objectively racist mindset. At the same time, how much of this is just, like, this is the thing that gets people the most angry and upset? Both the idea of an actual racist and also the idea of false accusations of racism, which I think most of Trump's supporters would say is what's occurring right now.
I think it plays beautifully to Trump's base because, he is giving back what he, has been lobbed at him. And I think Trump supporters love that. And I think there is I suspect that part and, one of the things is that people look at him and, the way he types and, capitalizes stuff and they think he's dumb. And he's obviously not, an intellectual or anything, but he's, he's a smart operator. And I think he is going in his mind, he is going for those 80,000 people, that flipped the election to him last time. And they are, in an outsized way they are, you know, or the way the press talks about them, this may not actually be true, but it's that they are alienated post-industrial white workers who feel like they are no longer welcome in their country, which is being taken over by a kind of Benetton ad of you know, multiculturalism and multi-ethnic people. He is locking down that vote. And then one of the credible questions from a strategy point of view is just, will his rhetoric and those around, people around him, will that actually get out a vote that's a protest vote against this, whether it's from blacks who did not come out for Hillary Clinton in the numbers that they did for Barack Obama, to come out? I think, you know, and people of similar mindset to defeat him.
Catherine, building on kind of your point of like, this is the ultimate boomerang. If that is true, it's worth pointing out that, yes, there's a lot of people who kind of flocked to Trump because in some part they're sick of being called outright racist, or sort of the insinuation that they were. And so like, yeah, you think I am? Well, how about this? Part of that process, too, is then even though you're always complaining about the unfair accusations of racism, as I pointed out at the beginning, Trump called Elijah Cummings racist. like the same people. It's just like with criticizing the media or, you know, kind of snowflake culture, the same people who complain about racism are now like turning around and accusing people of racism too.
Well, it's worth pointing out AOC called Nancy Pelosi racist, or she wondered in a tweet, like, why is Nancy Pelosi picking on people?
Yeah, I mean,
of
the
color?
Way you do well, it is the Kamala Harris has the best way, yeah. Which is to say, I'm not calling you a racist, but that's how you do it successfully in Democratic politics right now. Go ahead.
Well,
Catherine.
Just so I guess that this is what I'm saying is it feels like the Kamala approach of implying that someone is a racist, leaning into that, whatever, that was more common for a very long time. And now we've sort of crossed over, and to just outright call both your enemies, but also, as you mentioned, sometimes people in your own party, you know, to say that they're a racist, to call that out. Like, if that becomes just part of the standard discourse, like, what is the next escalation? Like, we had kind of held off on this idea of explicitly calling quote unquote mainstream reputable successful politicians outright racist until things were really bad, until it was like, oh, here's a photo of you at the Klan rally, right? And now, I suppose you could say, like, Trump has crossed that line. He basically has like tweeted photos of himself at a Klan rally effectively, but it strikes me that, like, we are now going to be due for another ultimate taboo, like another peak escalation. And I can't even imagine what that's going to look like.
So is this where the X-Men franchise becomes real and Trump will start accusing people of being mutants or members of Homo Superior? Where do you go after this? Catherine, I hope that what happens instead is that people kind of walk it back and we actually, you know, and I can hear the laughter already, but, you know, that we actually start talking about what's going on. Baltimore is a city like a lot of American cities. It hit its peak in 1950 in population. The area around it is growing, and it's actually partly because of its proximity to Washington, D.C. is actually a pretty vibrant metro area, but it's fucked up. It's a badly run city, and it has been for a long time. You know, can we actually start talking about what sorts of policies might actually have a positive impact on cities in America?
One thing that I find striking in all of this is the contrast between the kind of national, you know, we need to talk about what's happening in Appalachia and, you know, have our elegies for the hillbillies and you know, restore a big coal as a way to help these distressed communities. There's a very strong sense of empathy towards certain distressed parts of America. And this doesn't strike me as empathy necessarily towards.
So when Trump talks about Baltimore as a vermin infested hellhole, he's not putting himself in the shoes.
No
of
human
blacks
being
in
would
Baltimore.
Want to
Oddly,
live there.
Right. Again, like, that just gets back to my original point, which we've also made other times on this podcast. Like, he's walking right up to explicitly referring to the people who live in Baltimore's poor neighborhoods, who are overwhelmingly black, as not human, like not human beings. That's incredible. And I think
except it's not incredible, except this is what Donald Trump has run on since the beginning, since they're not sending us their best. They're sending us the rapists and the drug dealers, since very fine people on both sides, since the entire feud with the squad.
And to be fair,
since the Central Park Five, since his father's, since the housing developments that he ran in New York, this has been the defining, maybe not the, but certainly a defining aspect of Trump's public personality for decades, and the defining aspect of his political candidacy, at least since 2015, is at minimum of what you might call a soft touch racism that often shades into just a kind of hard touch, very outright, flat out racism.
I do also think, I mean, Trump's word salad way of communicating has always made it a little bit harder to quite point at the thing where he says black people are subhuman, because he never finishes a sentence, like creates a full well-structured sentence that has an idea in it. But at the same time, I think it's at least worth asking the question, like, is what Trump is doing now, was it basically normal 20 years ago or 40 years ago? And this is something that has come up a couple times, like super predators and welfare mothers and, you know, all of 90s politics. Read through this
lens. I think
you got
to go back to the 80s. And maybe 80s politics.
Right. Like, I guess I'm just wondering, like, and this is, I guess, just me further fomenting generational warfare. Like, is part of the problem here that Trump's rhetoric hasn't changed and our expectations have?
I think part of it is that when he talks about, and this was huge in the 2016 campaign, when he would talk about, you know, American carnage, and like he was talking about New York in the 1970s and maybe the early 80s. And I think that's when his brain kind of turned off, and he's still living in that world, even though he knows things have gotten better, et cetera. When he has a tweet, you know, saying that Al Sharpton hates white people, that is not an illegitimate read of Al Sharpton, especially if you go back to Sharpton burst onto the New York scene and the national scene in the 80s around what was revealed to be a hoax that a black woman named Tawana Brawley said that she had been attacked by a bunch of white racists and had the N-word and stuff scrawled on her body and feces, et cetera. And Sharpton backed her, and it turned, and he pushed to, after one particular guy who was identified as one of the perpetrators who was completely innocent. And it was, you know, that was racial politics in New York was absolutely open and nasty as hell. And I think Trump is still living in that era. And it's, again, it's not that it's a wrong read, but it's like really, really outdated. And I don't think it was the general society. I think it was a particular type of New Yorker. The other thing that is odd about this is that, you know, on another level, Trump has been, you know, the criminal justice reform stuff is like, you know, is indisputable. It's good stuff. And it's going against the way that he talks about blacks. The Apprentice had a large black following. Trump in many ways is comfortable around black people. The racism is a bizarre kind of aberration, and he does seem to be the type of person where, you know, he would say without any irony or distance, you know, that, you know, some of my best friends or some of my best workers were black. How can I be racist? It's not helping anything for sure.
Let's go to a quick lightning round. Catherine's mentioned a couple of times about her vacation on a yacht last week. I think
not a yacht.
Catherine, Nick, and
you took a yacht to your private island vacation.
That's none of that.
At least
true.
Three out of the four of us spent at least some time on the vacay last week, and I was struck by the conversations and the questions that normals had for me about the politics. And I'm curious to hear what the normals were asking you all. I will go first. The a question that came up at least twice, two different people were, and I think this sort of speaks to the way that people consume politics, and also maybe are receptive to libertarian counterarguments, was, why is Rand Paul such a terrible monster who wants to kill all the first responders to 9/11? Which is in reference to the fact that he held for very briefly
a bill that ended up passing overwhelmingly, I believe it was 97-2, creating a limitless fund to help the medical bills of 9/11 first responders up until the year 2092. And what Rand Paul and Mike Lee were doing was saying, we shouldn't make this a unanimous consent vote. We should actually have a full vote with everyone's vote recorded on it. So it delayed this by, what, a week? And after which I would, when I explained this, people say, oh, well, that's different than what I was hearing about this bill. But I think it speaks to the kind of idiotic way in which the majority of political journalism is communicated. So much of that particular story was John Stewart, firefighters, Mitch McConnell, evil. And that's just not actually how policy is done. And it speaks to an interesting failure, but also the way that kind of a-hole-ish sounding libertarianism plays out there in the world when people aren't paying that much attention. Catherine.
Which is helped along by Rand Paul telling Ilhan Omar to go to Somalia come back with like a PowerPoint.
Catherine, yeah. What did the normals ask you on the yacht?
I don't know how many normals I spent last week with, since it was just a bunch of people who live inside the Beltway who all went to Delaware and hung out on the beach. But most of the people, in fact, I think all of them that I was on vacation with were not involved in politics or associated politics industries. So there's some normal there. And the main thing that I picked up was that no one is paying attention to policy at all at this point. And I think that's always a good reminder for us bubble dwellers. They are sort of aware of who the candidates are, but even DC folk, you know, when I said stuff like, you know, Kamala Harris is being hypocritical in her claims about how she's reversed her different stances, like, not on the radar. Absolutely not. Like, just basic human personalities were out there on the radar. And a lot of like, hey, we like this Mayor Pete fella. A lot of, you know, we here at Reason were having a sort of informal conversation in our Slack while I was away about our rank order of the viable Democrats by, you know, from sort of least horrific to most horrific. And I found myself increasingly on team, well, maybe Biden won't ruin America as much as the others, which is a very uncomfortable place for me to be. And I'm not sure it's the permanent place I will be, but talked with some folks there about that and found broadly that like non-bubble DC-ish, lefty-ish people do not like Biden and do not want his moderate oldster bullshit. So those were my takeaways.
Nick, what did you get any normals questions during your week off?
And it was split evenly between people saying, people who tended to be businessmen saying, you know, the economy is doing really well, and attributing that to Trump and kind of a deregulation or a pro-business sensibility kind of slowly oozing down, you know, trickle down kind of business dereg. And then people who are absolutely terrified by everything, and that Trump is, you know, obviously the advance guard of, you know, a new world fascist order. And like Catherine, I mean, nobody was really talking about anything specific, but that's, you know, so I wouldn't say I'm looking forward to it, but, you know, I will bet anybody, you know, that the winner of the 2000 or 2020 election is going to win with like between 45% and 48% of the vote. And it's going to be ugly and nasty. And it's going to be more, it's going to be like Temple basketball in the late 80s, you know, where the win is going to be eked out at in the very last seconds. And it's going to be a real nail.
The other question that I always get in such situations, which I answer with increasing levels of vitriol, like, why the hell are you asking me, you fool, is, so what's going to happen in 2020? Why are you asking a journalist? Jesus Christ, have you learned nothing? Peter, have you ever taken a vacation, including last week? And if so, what did the normal people tell you about the alligators in Florida?
I have not taken a vacation, and in general, I don't spend a lot of time talking to normals. That's to protect them, for their sake. not mine. So it works out better for everybody that way. But I did go to Las Vegas and spend a couple of days at Freedom Fest, which was great and fascinating. And one of the best parts of it was meeting an awful lot of podcast fans. I mean to compliment you when I say that makes you a little bit not normal. And it was everyone who I met who was a podcast fan was absolutely delightful. And I just want to say you people are great.
Agree. Shout out to the pod
fans.
That's
very nice and sweet. Okay.
They are the best people in the world.
Let's salt that compliment. Yes, Catherine, I did that. By having Peter tell us what other terrible bit of culture he consumed.
People like these recommendations, Matt.
I hope so. I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's the new Quentin Tarantino movie. It is just a fascinating piece of filmmaking, a fascinating window into the Tarantino cinematic mindset. I'm not going to talk too much about the way that it ends, but it ends in a way that's very fascinating. And is not, I think, what people are expecting from a movie that is set on the eve of the Manson family murders with a fictional leading
the
man.
The Manson family murders, you mean the Tate-LaBianca murders, please.
Whatever you
remember
would like
the
to,
victims, Peter? Like dis- remember the victims.
Whatever you'd like to call them, I think. And it's just this sort of beautifully designed, slow-paced film that is also a kind of a defense, an argument for movie violence. And it really kind of brought me back to the arguments that were had in particular about Quentin Tarantino's movies and some of the films that he got his start writing, True Romance and Natural Born Killers, which were the target of Bob Dole's wrath. Bob Dole, who had not seen these movies, but really complained in the mid-90s about how they were coarsening the culture and ruining our children and all of that. And Tarantino was like, you know, whatever, this jerk has not seen my movies at all. Of course, people always blame the playwrights. And in a lot of ways, Tarantino's later films really seem like a kind of response to that, in which he argues, he's making an argument, and especially in, if you take Inglourious Basterds, in which first of all, a team of Jewish assassins just walks around World War II Germany murdering Nazis and scalping them kind of for pleasure. And kind of for joyous revenge. And then at the end, a Jewish woman whose family was murdered by Nazis kills Hitler by setting a movie theater on fire. And what he is making movies about is the ways that movies can serve as a vehicle for deferred historical fantasy revenge. And in the ways in which movie violence, in particular, can be a vehicle for catharsis and for righting historical wrongs. And it's a kind of fascinating view of how movies can make our lives better and why they are important and meaningful.
Nicholas Patrick John Gillespie, what have you consumed since the last time we gathered?
Yeah, that is not my name, but I actually caught up on a couple episodes of Black Mirror on Netflix. I realized that there's only three episodes in the new season, and it's pretty good. The other thing that I actually consume more of is the Norm Macdonald show, also on Netflix. I highly recommend it. It's the best interview show on TV. He has people on like Jane Fonda and Judge Judy. And I mean, it's absolutely hilarious. And Norm Macdonald, he's Canadian. So I realize, you know, when we kick out all the immigrants, he's going to have to go back to his shithole country. But while he's here, check out the Norm Macdonald show on Netflix. You won't be sorry that you did.
Catherine?
I consumed lots of things on my vacation, but the one I want to recommend is a book called We Are Legion, We Are Bob. And it's by Dennis Taylor. And it is basically this Neal Stephenson novel that Peter and I have been ranting about fall, as if it was written by Charlie Strauss or maybe Terry Pratchett. Like, it's the exact same premise, but just treated like for kind of light comedy. And it's essentially, what if you got really rich, froze your brain, and then were brought back under circumstances that were a little different than you expected? Discuss.
Is the author British?
I don't think so, no.
Strauss and Pratchett both have that kind of like
it, and
wry,
it doesn't, it
they
actually,
they're from the UK and they both have that wry UK sensibility.
It's wry, but it's not British-y, as far as I can tell. The fact that the series is referred to as the Bobaverse tells you a lot about what you need to know. Yeah, I recommend it if you are in the mood for some kind of light science fiction and or explicitly as a contrast to the self-serious high drama of the Neal Stephenson treatment of this question. Because actually, as listeners to this podcast know, my theory is always that humanity will be sort of silly and muddle through and it will probably be fine rather than that there will be high stakes, high drama, zero sum, you know, disaster. So probably the Bobaverse is what we actually will live in and not some kind of Stevensonian.
There's a lot of exuberant zaniness in Neal Stephenson, just not in the new book. The new book is
very
is less
self-serious.
Zany.
Yeah. So we are Legion. We are Bob.
What I experienced, in addition to the first public concert of the brothers Steve in more than 30 years, who are friends of mine and they're great, and they have a new record out that has at least one co-songwriting credit by Matt Welch. Not that I'm plugging friend stuff here on the podcast. And that was great, but it was Disneyland. I went to Disneyland for the first time in almost a decade. And my recommendation, besides passing along that it's super expensive to go to Disneyland, in case that wasn't clear, is that, this is in California, the real Disneyland, is that it's really, really empty right now. So for those of you who are thinking about ever going to Disneyland, the time to go is in the summer of 2019. Because
how is the California Adventure?
Didn't go. Didn't go. Still have never been. No, I mean, if you're, you have.
That's the new part of the park. It's like the big expansion over the past 20 years.
You have to choose. If you're going to go for one day, you can't go to both because you'll just kill yourself.
Why didn't you go for 2 days? I mean, you know, Russians love their children more than you love your children.
Because I'm not going to subject my 4-year-old to like an exhibition on the green and green architecture, brothers. If that's the case, I'll just go to Pasadena and drive around and point at buildings.
The new Star Wars area.
No, that's why it's empty. This is the key. Don't go to the new Star Wars. Everyone's like in the new Star Wars area. So you just don't walk to that part of the park.
Did you go on Space Mountain, Matt? What was the ride? Give us a takeaway. What was the highlight? The Indiana Jones thing?
It was a 5-minute wait to It's a Small World. My God. So it's all about line avoidance for me because we all know lines are socialism. Lines are failure. And so you don't have to wait in lines for It's a Small World. And It's a Small World, they freshened it up. And they include pretty seamlessly a bunch of,
Somalia? Do they have Somalia and Somaliland? Or do they just have one?
By the Eiffel Tower and a bunch of can-can dancers, which I appreciate.
Did you go on the Pirates of the Caribbean?
Would you say that the Small World ride is like an animatronic defense of globalism?
Yeah. And also
the last place.
Skillful
the last
product
place.
Placement because you have the Toy Story people in there and Ariel. The other thing that I adore about the place, and I can't recommend highly enough, is right in the entrance there's the I forget what it's called, but like Abraham Lincoln, you know, sings or so.
Yeah. The Hall of Presidents.
Jesus
Christ, Matt.
You don't get America Sings. You don't get the full presidential thing. You just get a patriotic film and a look at Abraham Lincoln, who stands up on stage and gives a little bit of a talk. And then you walk afterwards into.
Wait, does he do it in that deep voice? Because he had a kind of a high voice. We've seen Lincoln. We know what it was like.
It's a deep voice.
I'm so glad that Daniel Day-Lewis retired from making movies.
God. I mean, except for that awful seamstress movie that he made. You walk out of the Abe Lincoln thing and your heart is swelling with America the Beautiful. And then you walk into this hallway of American icons, pictures of them, including Michael Jackson. and Elvis and Martin Luther King. It's all like great and crazy and wonderful and also air conditioned because it's super hot. So that's really good.
Last of the Mohicans is a great movie, guys.
No, it's not.
It's the worst. It's the worst Michael Mann movie of all time.
in minute like 59 of this podcast.
They mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis. I get 30 seconds.
No.
Daniel Day-Lewis, with the exception of Bill the Butcher and Room with a View, we could live without him.
Didn't Disney solve the problem of lines with capitalism? Like, can't you like buy your way out of being in lines there now?
Only selectively.
Well, there's a flash pass.
Only selectively, it turns out. There's many such rides lack that fast pass, which is why I didn't go on Peter Pan, frankly. And that was a disappointment to a lot of members of my family.
I miss the era, and Matt, you remember this well, when Disney about to go out of business was a leading indicator of like how shitty America had become.
Yes.
Back in the 70s and 80s before they couldn't buy a hit movie.
And now
they
were putting out stuff like The Black Hole. Grossing movies domestically of 2019 are all Disney films.
It's really kind of amazing, you know, that, I mean, they were going the way of F.W. Woolworth and all of that kind of stuff.
Hey, Marvel went bankrupt in the late 1990s, as did President Trump. So I think maybe he went bankrupt in the early 90s. But in any case,
I should point out,
maybe that's the leading indicator of success in 2019.
People who went bankrupt.
Your
in the
90s bankruptcy.
Fans of the MCU will be disappointed that Disneyland, not just Disneyland, but the Disney store on Hollywood Boulevard, which I also went to, God damn my soul, sorely lack integration of the MCU. Can't get a lot of Spider-Man stuff there, Peter. So my 11-year-old was bummed out about that. But that's
Spider-Man is actually completely owned by owned by Sony. But is now licensed to Disney and Marvel Studios to incorporate inside their universe. But still, the rights are technically owned by Sony, which is why the Venom movie is a Sony film that's not part of the MCU.
I apologize to everyone for giving Peter another 30 seconds.
Would Quentin Tarantino be good for the Aquaman sequel, do you think,
And that's
Peter?
All the time we have today for the Reason Podcast Editor's Roundtable Edition.
A defense of underwater. I want to see him do the incredible Mr. Limpet remake.
Tarantino is, in fact, teasing that his next movie will be an R-rated Star Trek film set in canon that is like Pulp Fiction in space. I'm not making this up at all.
Save us, Matt.
I can totally see
Goodbye.
That.
Bye.